Now that's some mighty fine music in church this morning. I wonder what the transcendentalists would have thought if they'd been walking by. Probably the full range of human expression. In a passage from Walden near the end of the chapter Sounds, Henry David Thoreau writes, "Sometimes on Sundays I hear the bells, the Lincoln, Acton, Bedford, or Concord bell, when the wind was favorable, a faint, sweet, and as it were, natural melody, worth importing into the wilderness. At a sufficient distance over the woods, this sound acquires a certain vibratory hum, as if the pine needles in the horizon were the strings of a harp which it swept. All sound heard at the greatest possible distance produces one and the same effect, a vibration of the universal lyre, just as the intervening atmosphere makes a distant ridge of earth interesting to the eye by the azure tint it imparts to it. There came to me in this case a melody which the air had strained and which had conversed with every tree and needle and leaf in the wood, that portion of the sound which the elements had taken up and modulated and echoed from vale to vale. The echo is to some extent an original sound, and therein is the magic and charm of it. It is not merely a repetition of what was worth repeating in the bell, but partly the voice of the wood, the same trivial words and notes sung by a wood nymph." Each of us can picture Henry David Thoreau walking in the woods on a Sunday morning. We can see him in our mind's eye somewhere near Walden Pond or White's Pond. We can imagine him walking in the great meadow or at the shore of Fairhaven Bay. We can see him cocking his head to hear the faint sound of a church bell, the same bell that calls us into the church. We see a small smile break out on his face as his mind is drawn to this church by the sound of its bell, a call which he wistfully ignores. Now, we love Henry David Thoreau, you and me. We honestly love him, don't we? First Parish in Concord proudly claims him as one of its own. The surrounding town honors him in street names and plaques and natural spaces. Yet Henry never allowed himself to be captured. He never let himself be owned by society or by religion. And maybe it is his wildness that attracts us so. We, with our overly full lives lived with cares piled on our shoulders, we long to be as unconcerned with society's trappings as Henry. We long to walk among the pines with no more concern than a raccoon or a deer. But there is work to be done. There are mouths to be fed. There is money to be made. There are committees to be run. There are injustices to be righted. So, unlike Henry, we enter the church at the sound of the bell. We enter not because we think that God can only be found here, but because we have scheduled 1 hour for God this week, and this is it. On January 5th, 1841, 23-year-old Henry David Thoreau wrote a short note to the town clerk. "I do not wish to be considered a member of the first parish in this town," the note read, and it was signed simply Henry D. Thoreau. That note exists to this day. It's over in the archives in the library. and both the town and the church have complied with his request. Though it stings a little to realize that Henry did not want to join us, we have forgiven him his standoffishness because we like the other things that he did and said. We like how his words in part led Unitarian Universalism to adopt its seventh principle that calls for the respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We like how his activism encourages us to stand against injustices in our day. We like how his love of nature calls us to the woods ourselves. This favorite son, this wayward child, this prophet in our midst, this much-loved Thoreau, also represents a deep ambivalence toward organized religion that we also share. We pause with him in the woods at the sound of a church bell, wondering if we should stay where we are or follow its call. Henry David Thoreau was dedicated in this church and raised in it. The 80-year-old minister, Dr. Ezra Ripley, must have seemed ancient to the boy Henry. His mother and his aunts sandwiched him in a pew on Sundays, and it must have seemed an eternity before he was released. The bland, pious Christianity of his day would have fallen on his ears as quaint and ineffective. The posturing and posing at church of the town's best families would surely have irked him no end. And to hear a dry sermon preached on the weekly biblical selection from the lectionary must have made him long for silence and birdsong. I hope the case is not the same for you. So as soon as he was fully a man, he left First Parish in Concord. He left this formal room for the wild, expansive cathedral of nature. I imagine Thoreau's departure was little noticed by the church in 1841. And for anyone but us, his separation from First Parish in Concord remains complete to today. As I was preparing for this sermon, I happened upon a map of Concord featuring all of the places connected to Thoreau. Finding Thoreau in Concord, a map and guide of places important to Henry David Thoreau, cheerfully lists the Colonial Inn, the Town House, Orchard House, Emerson's House, the Wayside, and even the Old Manse. Of course, my eye scanned the list for any mention of First Parish. Absolutely none. We don't even warrant a marker on the map. This publication serves as a modern-day example of the divide between Thoreau's secular admirers and his Unitarian Universalist admirers. And that divide is pretty wide. The map accurately shows Thoreau traveling widely in Concord, but completely avoids its most central house of worship. It was as if Henry had never entered the place. Only in death did Henry David Thoreau return briefly to First Parish in Concord. His casket sat right there in front of the pulpit on May 9th, 1862, as Ralph Waldo Emerson preached his eulogy and his friends and family mourned him. Only in death, when he had no choice. Only in death, when he had no choice, could he re-enter the church of his childhood. But I say that there is a way to welcome him now, not as a saint or an eccentric. I say we at First Parish in Concord can reclaim our wayward son by actually listening to him, maybe for the first time ever. Henry David Thoreau was not anti-religious. In fact, I would argue that he had a spirituality too deep and too profound to be seen by his own church. A little more than a year after he wrote his note to the town clerk, Henry recorded the following thoughts in his journal. Is not nature rightly read as that of which she is commonly taken to be the symbol merely, that is, as God? I must receive my life as passively as the willow leaf that flutters over the brook. I must not be for myself, but God's work, and that is always good. I will wait the breezes patiently and grow as nature shall determine. The constant content of the animal comes of resting quietly in God's palm. I feel as if I could at any time resign my life and the responsibility of living into God's hands, and then become as innocent, free from care, as a plant or stone. The greatest gift Thoreau and the other transcendentalists gave Unitarian Universalism was the freedom to experience the holy in nature. They surely were not the first people to find God in nature, but they are the direct ancestors who freed us to think and believe differently. They pointed us away from a carefully orchestrated church life to a messy, wild spiritual life, unconcerned with either salvation or social standing. If we hear Thoreau write, we will hear him calling us to a life that is less concerned with material things and more concerned with the quality of life. If we hear him right, we will hear him call us to love people more than possessions. He tells us to free our minds and the rest will follow. Whether it is true or not, the story is told that when Ralph Waldo Emerson visited Henry at the jail where he was spending a night in civil disobedience and asked, Henry, what are you doing in that jail cell? Henry replied, Ralph, the question is, what are you doing out there? He would look at us with the same curiosity and ask, what has First Parish in Concord been doing since I left? When I stand in our parish hall and parlor and look at the portraits of the ministers on the walls, I know that there's not a person represented there who did not care deeply for this congregation and its members. There's not a man or woman on those walls who did not pray for the members of this church. There is not a man or woman on those walls who did not experience both great joy and great sorrow in leading this congregation. When I look at the portraits of Ezra Ripley and Barzilai Frost gazing at the bust of Thoreau on the fireplace mantel, I see the two men who would have been Thoreau's ministers had he stayed. Ripley saw this congregation through 63 years as its minister. He died at age 90, September after Henry rejected First Parish. And Frost pastored our church faithfully for 20 years, including 16 after Ripley's death. These men were not in the woods when the church bell rang. Thoreau is remembered around the world for his words and his actions. Ripley and Frost are almost unknown outside Concord, Massachusetts. And yet this congregation persists. This congregation bumbles along toward its 380th birthday. It lumbers on awkwardly in a little-known denomination drowned out by shriller religious voices. and yet the bell atop our steeple rings every Sunday, calling us to church, calling us to our better selves. Our bell rings and is surely heard in the far distance by some walker in the woods, but we hear it differently than that walker. The bell for us is not a far distant sound. It is up close and real and personal. We belong to First Parish in Concord, and we have no intentions of leaving. We believe the work of transformation can happen here. And though we do not discount transformation can happen elsewhere, we know it can happen here. We have seen it. I was recently asked if I thought Henry David Thoreau would be more comfortable at First Parish in Concord today than he was in his lifetime. My answer was a qualified no. I said Henry would admire the bold work that we've done through the decades to fight for the rights of others. I said he would be happy to see how much we have embraced nature and fought for her survival. Henry would approve of our children going outside for their religious education classes. He would smile to see our Black Lives Matter banner. But I don't think he would come inside for very long. Not because he would disapprove, but because building an institution that lasts centuries is different spiritual work than knowing God immediately. Henry would say we spend too much time talking about what we should be doing and too little time doing it. He would laugh at the ways that we wrestle with a pledge drive and a budget and policies and procedures. Henry would be no more interested in signing our membership book today than he was in 1841. He might get stuck on a committee. And all of this is just fine. For we are all on a religious journey together, some of us inside the church and some of us outside it. But the far distant sound of a church bell still falls on the walker's ear. The same heart that tugs toward nature also tugs toward the meeting house. The same holiness that pervades a glade of trees pervades this light-filled room. If Henry stops by First Parish for a visit, we will gladly welcome him in, but he is unlikely to stay very long. And if we bump into him on a forest path, we too will recognize him as the fellow believer that he is. So be it. Amen.